So today is Mother's Day, and starting today, we're going to launch into a series called God's Powerful Women, and we're going to be learning about courage and trust and faith and wisdom through stories of women, various women, some of them famous, others unknown in Scripture. We're going to look at women who put their trust in God. This is not a series about how to be a woman, all right? I'm sure people would pay money to come and hear me talk about how to be a woman. And you'd love to hear me teach you how to be a woman, but that's not what this is about. Maybe another day we'll do that, and that will hopefully be funny. But this series is about how to be a godly person, how to be a powerfully godly person, and we're going to look at examples of powerful women of God in the Bible. And today, I want to focus on the story of one of those unknown women. We don't know her name. We only know that she's where she's from. She's a Canaanite woman, she's talked about as. That's what she's named. She's a Canaanite woman. Canaanites were one of the enemies of the Jewish people. And what we do know about her is that she's a mom. And she has a daughter who is sick and not well. And we also know that she demonstrated a unique kind of faith that is rarely found in this world. So her story is found in Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 to 28. Again, you can go into our app and you can follow along there. You can follow along in the bulletin. We'll have it on the screen. But before we get into the text, I want to give you some background information and set the scene so that you'll understand her encounter with Jesus when we get to it. All right, so let me give you some background about what's been happening that leads up to this encounter this woman has with Jesus. So right before Matthew 15, in Matthew chapter 14, Jesus feeds the 5,000 men plus the women and the children that are there. So thousands and thousands of people, Jesus feeds with just five loaves of bread and two little fish. And talk about a miraculous display of power, right? That God is able to care for us. Not to mention he walks on the water, and Peter and the disciples see him, and they're scared, and Peter says, oh, you know, if that's really you, Jesus, then tell me to come out to you. And he says, come out to me. And Peter starts to come out, but then Peter loses faith. And then Jesus heals all kinds of people once they get to the other shore. And even in the face of all these things, where you think people would believe in him or start to believe that he was the Messiah sent from God, that he was God, They hemmed and they hawed and they wavered and they weren't sure. Even the disciples weren't sure. Even their faith was like, I don't know. Show us some more signs. And the religious leaders, instead of leading the way and recognizing who Jesus was, they instead were certain he was bad. They were sure that he was not the Messiah. He couldn't be the Messiah because he wasn't fitting into their rules and into their categories. And so they ignored all the good things he did. And they focused on things like, well, they noticed Jesus wasn't having his disciples wash their hands before they ate. And to them, washing your hands before you ate was the way you kept yourself from becoming impure. Because they thought that if I eat, you know, and there's dirt on my hands, then that gets inside of me and that's what makes me impure, that makes me sinful, that makes me not right before God. So I have to wash my hands because otherwise I end up eating with and dirt gets into me and then that's what makes me unrighteous and then I can't go to God. That was their thinking. And so they said, Jesus, what's wrong with you? Why don't you have them wash their hands? Obviously, you know, you guys are unclean. Obviously, you don't really know God. Over hand washing. So Jesus calls the crowds to him and says, okay, everyone, I want you to listen. They're upset because we don't wash our hands and they think that makes us spiritually unclean. But let me tell you, the reality is, and he tells them, it's not what you put inside of you that makes you unrighteous. It's what comes out of your heart that makes you unrighteous. And then he proceeds to tell the people, look, you know, these people who are leading you and telling you these things, they're blind. And if you follow blind leaders, where are you going to end up? He said, if the blind follow the blind, they all just end up in a ditch. So he tells them, stop following these guys. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't know God, even if he stares them in the face. You could imagine things might get a little heated after that, right? And so Jesus leaves town, heads up north, and actually heads all the way up out of Israelite territory, out of Jewish territory into cross the border into Gentile territory. And you could just picture the religious leaders chasing after him up to the border saying, no, don't go in there. If you go in there, now you're going to really be unclean. If you even just step foot on the ground that those people walk on, that's going to make you unclean before God. And that just shows that you really don't know God and don't love God, because how could you go be around those people? They're going to make you unclean. Jesus just gets away so that they don't take him because they're already mad at him, and don't kill him then because it wasn't time yet. And Jesus goes and he gets away. And he shakes his head as he crosses the border into this land that is Gentile land, non-Jewish land. And there's an irony going on here that we need to understand before we get to this woman's story and her faith. Because Jesus' mission is to Israel. Right? God promised Israel that he would bless the world through Israel, that all the world would become his children through Israel. And he promised Israel he was going to send a Messiah, a king like King David, to lead his people. And so Jesus is the Jewish Messiah sent to fulfill what Israel was called to be and do all this. And once he's done that, once he's offered this salvation to the Jews, then he will send it out into the world. Picture it like the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus takes those 5 loaves and those 2 fish, and he has his disciples there with him, and he breaks the bread, and he gives it to the disciples, and then what do? They go and they give it out to the other people who are sitting there. And in the end, if someone brought me a donut from the back right now, and I broke it in half and gave it to you, and you broke it in half and gave it to her, and you broke it in half, at some point you run out of halves, or you get to a point where that half is so small it's the size of an atom, and if you split it, then we're going to have a lot of trouble. So we don't want to do that, right? Because what happens? We run out. But that's not the case with Jesus. That's not the case with this living bread that he calls himself. Jesus gives it to the disciples, and they in turn give it out. And that's a picture of Jesus' ministry and what he's doing. He has come to give himself for the Jewish people. And then they in turn are to take and bring him to the world. And he's giving himself to them, and yet they're rejecting him. They're turning him away. They're saying, we don't believe in you. And Jesus is performing sign after sign, and they're saying, give us another sign. He's demonstrating he's the Messiah. And they're like, I don't know, Jesus. And Jesus is looking for faith. He's looking for faith. But he can't find it in Israel. And things are getting heated. He's making the religious leaders more and more angry to the point where they're about to start to try to kill him. And he knows this, so he gets away. He leaves Israelite territory, gets up into the Gentile territory, and that's where he encounters this Canaanite woman, and surprisingly, it's where he finds the faith that he's been looking for. So we get to Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28, and we see Jesus' encounter with the woman. He says, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. That's this northern area where people like the Canaanites are from. And this Canaanite woman, it says, from that vicinity, came to him crying out, Lord, son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter's demon-possessed and suffering terribly. Jesus didn't answer a word. So his disciples came to him and they urged him, send her away. She keeps crying out after us. And he answers his disciples and he says, I was sent to the lost sheep of Israel. And the woman comes and kneels before Jesus. Lord, help me, she said. And he replied, it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs. And she says, yes, it is, Lord. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And then Jesus says to her, woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted. And her daughter was healed at that moment. And okay, I know that sounds like a pretty awkward exchange, right? Some of you are thinking, wow, Jesus is kind of mean. He doesn't want to help her. He doesn't even want to deal with her. He kind of sounds like he calls her a dog. But I want you to think about this in light of everything that I just told you about what comes ahead of this, right? Jesus traveled all the way up there, a couple days travel probably to get there, and went into this town. If Jesus had a problem with going and being among these people, he would not have taken that time and gone all the way up there and gone into that town and been there. He came there. He went there on purpose. He obviously doesn't believe that contact with them is going to make him unclean because of what he just said, right? So something profound is going on here, and it has to do with faith. Because Jesus is looking for the kind of faith that doesn't stumble and give up when it encounters obstacles, the way much of our faith does. You know, if hand washing can trip up religious people and trip up their faith, what will it take to trip up this woman's faith? In Mark's gospel, he tells this story and he points out that Jesus was in a house. So picture Jesus and his disciples get there into this town and they go into a house and they're there inside and this woman is outside screaming and calling to them, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David." Pay attention to that. "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David." There's history, a rich history behind what she's saying. It's not just words. She knows that Israel is waiting for a Messiah to come to be like King David was. She knows the expectation that a king is going to rise up from the line of King David. And when she comes to Jesus, she's asking for mercy. She's calling him Lord, Son of David. What she's doing is she's acknowledging, "Jesus, you're the king. You're the king." Even though there is another guy named Herod who's the king of Israel, she doesn't believe in him. Even though there's the emperor of Rome, no. She comes to Jesus. Because in those days, if you've exhausted all of your ability to solve a problem, who do you go to? Today, we go to the government, "Hey, please help me. I need assistance with this or that." In their case, you go to the king and you beg for mercy. She goes to the king. He's the one with infinite mercy, infinite resources. And she begs him for mercy. Day after day after day, the Jewish people saw Jesus demonstrate that he was the king, the Messiah. And they hemmed and they hawed, and I don't know. And he just barely sets foot in this town, and this woman immediately acknowledges who he is. She's yelling it in the street. "You're the Son of David. You're the king. You're the only one who can help me. You're the Lord." And the disciples, they get annoyed. This is annoying to them. Some of them are probably outside and like, "Shh, be quiet. We're just trying to relax. We've had enough trouble today." You know, they're telling her to be quiet and go away. They're not worried about her daughter. They're not worried about what's going on in her life. They're like, "Please just stop." And she won't stop. She won't give up. She won't give in. And so finally they come to Jesus and say, "Jesus, would you please just give her what she wants and get rid of her." That's what they're saying. And that's why Jesus looks at them and says, "I was sent for the lost sheep of Israel." Because Jesus is trying to teach them something about faith. They're confused and scratching their heads. They've seen Jesus heal non-Jewish people before. They know he has no problem healing non-Jewish people before. So what is he telling them when he says, "Look, no, I was sent for the lost people of Israel"? What's going on here? Jesus is looking for faith, and he can't find it in Israel. But this woman's faith is going to teach his disciples something, and it's going to teach us something. It's something we all need to see. So somehow she gets into the house. Now she gets to the point where she falls down at Jesus' feet and kneels before him and says, "Lord, help me," she says. And he replies, "It's not right to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs, is it?" And she says, "Yes, it is, Lord. Even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." All right, again, that doesn't feel good. What's going on? What are they talking about? Both Jesus and this woman knew that the Jews looked at non-Jews as dogs. As the word they use for dogs here are those like small dogs that, you know, kind of hang out under the table and the kids would give them food. They were like the little pet dogs that they had, little ones that are running around under feet, right? So both Jesus and this woman knew that this was a huge roadblock, right? Why would you even come to me? I'm not one of your people, but you're coming to me and asking me for help. So Jesus puts this roadblock up and says, "Hey, look at this. Don't you see this? There's a roadblock between us. There's an obstacle between us. Why would you ask me for help? Don't you know that your people hate my people?" And Jesus does this in a lot of places. As you read through the Gospels and read through Jesus' life, you'll notice Jesus does this. The people come and profess, "I believe in you, Jesus. I'm going to follow you forever." And he says, "Okay, well, go sell everything you have and give it to the poor and then come follow me." And the guy says, all right, maybe not. All right, Jesus does this kind of thing. He puts up obstacles. What kind of faith do people have? Is it just this, I just want to be part of what's going on with you, Jesus? Or is it a faith that's going to break through the obstacles? You look at this woman and say, what kind of faith does this woman have? This woman has breakthrough faith. She has a faith that recognizes that even though Jesus is there to bless Israel, that blessing is intended for the entire world. That the people of God are not delineated by race or gender or nationality, but by faith in Jesus. And whatever will happen now is this time where the Gentiles are coming to Christ, those who are non-Jews, that the Jews have to come through Christ as well. And we'll see how all this plays out. There's things going on in the Jewish nation even today. Everyone's concerned, oh, like tomorrow the U.S. opens their embassy in Jerusalem. I don't know where all that's going. I know that God has a plan, and that plan always goes through Jesus. And Jesus came and offered salvation to the Jews. Most of them have rejected him. That doesn't mean God's plan is over. Paul talks about that as God's plan now is the world is getting blessed, and somehow through that, he's going to come back around and bring it all together. God will honor his promises and bring everyone into one people of God under Jesus. However all that happens, that's in God's hands. She breaks through all those obstacles even there. Even though those obstacles are still up, she doesn't care. Her faith doesn't sidestep the obstacle and say, oh, well, please bless me anyway. She says, she corrects Jesus. And this idea that, no, there's an obstacle between her and God. She says, no, there's no obstacle between me and God because it is right for me to get some bread. It is right for you to heal my daughter because we're your creatures too. We may not be the people you called. We may not be, you know, the chosen people, but we are your people. You made us. And so, yes, we do deserve. We do have a place at your table. And Jesus' breath is taken away. He's astounded at this faith he's found that just blasts through these obstacles and doesn't care. He came as the Jewish Messiah. The Jewish people, their faith trips over the smallest of things. He comes to this lady and there are huge obstacles and she just blasts through them because she has breakthrough faith. She breaks through mountain-sized obstacles. And so he looks at her with his eyes wide open and astounded, and he says, woman, you have incredible faith. You have huge faith. This is amazing. Let it be as you asked. And immediately her daughter's healed and restored. Jesus is looking for people with a faith that breaks through obstacles. Think about all the obstacles that her faith broke through. Besides the national ones, right? Think about the shame and the guilt that her faith had to break through to come to this moment. As a mom, there can be a lot of shame involved when something isn't right with your kids, right? There can be a lot of shame, like, what did I do wrong? How did I mess this up? How can my child be in this place, right? She breaks through that. Doesn't let that make her clam up. No, she still goes and begs God for mercy. She says, here I am. Here's what's going on. She breaks through that shame. There's all of us have shame involved with the things that we're weak at or broken at or where we're struggling and coming up short. And shame often makes us become insular and hide and cover. Faith makes us break out of that and say, yes, this is me. I am broken in this way. I am hurting in this way. This has hurt my life. I'm damaged in this way. Faith breaks through all of that and says, yep, this is me. God, please heal me. It doesn't go and hide behind the shame. Her faith broke through shame. You know, it was shameful to stand outside of that house in the street crying for help. How many people do that? Not many. It was shameful, sure, to fall on her face and beg. Shameful to admit she had a problem. Yeah, you might feel that way too. She didn't care. Her faith broke through the shame and through the pride. Yeah, maybe I'm not born into a place of privilege. I accept whatever my place is in this world, whatever. I'm a child of God. That's all I need to know. I come to you. Yeah, I'm not in control. I'm powerless to change things. I can't fix my child. I can't make their life better or different. I can't fix what's going on with them. Yeah, I'm powerless, and that may hurt my pride to admit it, but I don't care. I'm going to break through that with faith. Yeah, everyone's looking at me, seeing all my flaws, hearing my dirty laundry, whatever. I'm not going to let pride get in the way of me going in faith and saying, God, please heal me, because what I want is health. I want to be healthy, not have everyone think I'm healthy. Not have everyone think everything's okay. I want it to be right. a lot of us are sitting here with a faith that only comes to a point of saying, okay, yes, I believe in Jesus, but I'm not going to let anything show. I'm not going to reveal anything about the things that are broken in me or in my family. And so we live in this place boxed in. But breakthrough faith steps out of that and strives for real health, not just an appearance of health. Right? She breaks through shame and pride. In James 4:2, it tells us, you have not because you don't ask God. And James diagnoses that, what he means by that. He says, pride gets in the way of us coming to God. Pride and selfishness. We all want what everyone else has. We want to look like what we have, what everyone else has. We want to look like we're matching up with everybody else. And he's like, this is why you're always fighting each other and getting at each other's throats, because you're all just trying to look like you're fine. And so you're not coming to God because pride gets in the way of that. And when you do come to God, you're like, God, give me this, because you want to look like you have everything the way they do. It's just this shame and pride thing all blended up, and it's messing up our whole way of coming to God. It's ruining our faith. So our faith is just coming to God selfishly. So he says, no, breakthrough faith breaks through shame and pride. It acknowledges that God is God and I am not. And breakthrough faith breaks through, the next thing she breaks through is apathy, right? The disciples were pretty apathetic. They didn't ask Jesus to heal her daughter because they really cared about her daughter. They were annoyed that she was pestering them, that she was causing a scene, making a commotion. That's why they're outside, shh, be quiet, shh, stop, go away. And she won't. So like, Jesus, please just miracle her out of here, right? Sometimes we pray that way, don't we? God, please just fix that person so they don't bother me anymore. No. I can remember at times when I was younger when I would feel like the swell of faith in me, and I really wanted to, you know, go and reach my friends for Christ and see God do things in my church, and just me and like other friends would be on fire, like, yeah, come on, let's go and do things. And what quenched that in us was not, you know, objections from people who didn't know Jesus. It was apathy from those who did. Their apathy squelched what we had. And you know what? That meant that our faith wasn't breakthrough faith. That meant that we allowed other people's apathy to get in the way of our faith and what God wanted to do through us. And then I think in horror, how many times have I allowed my apathy to maybe squelch someone else's faith? You know, maybe you want to start building a more godly marriage, but your spouse, you know, they're kind of apathetic about it. And you let that just squelch it. So you're not coming to God. You're not talking about it. You're not praying about it. You're not having faith for that to happen because, oh, this is just the way it is. It's never going to change and you have no hope. You've let apathy quench your faith. Maybe you want to get your friends together and let your gatherings be more, you know, filled with God instead of other stuff. And you want to help each other grow and know Jesus and have your conversations be spiritual and enriching. And yet your friends are kind of like, yeah, all right, you know, okay, let's just pray for a couple minutes and then we'll go talk about, you know, the fun stuff, right? And maybe you just have this heart. I really want to my friends, my group of friends to be, you know, building each other up spiritually. And their apathy is keeping you from actually going after that. Faith. The faith Jesus is looking for is breakthrough faith. And that means you keep pushing. You keep going. You keep praying. You keep searching. You keep reaching for that. You don't let other people's apathy get in the way. Maybe there's a goal or a ministry God's put on your heart. Someone you want to help and everyone's like, ah, forget it. They're a lost cause. Something you want to do and all you see is people like, ah, okay, maybe that's interesting. But they're not there. Like, you're not getting anybody else excited. And their apathy has kind of made you feel like depressed. And you're giving up. But if God planted a seed of faith in your heart to do something, to go and accomplish something for him, don't let other people's apathy stop you from going and doing it. This woman did not let anyone else's apathy keep her from breaking through, because breakthrough faith breaks through apathy. She also broke through the societal boundaries, right? He's a Jew, she's a Canaanite, their people don't like each other. She doesn't care. She blasts straight through that. And here we are 2,000 years later, and we have just as many, if not more, societal boundaries that we have to put up with and deal with than they did then. Our societal boundaries are actually probably more complex than they've ever been. You know, who talks to who? Who's allowed to say this? What can you say? What can you do? There's all these walls that everyone's putting up. We need some people to start having faith that these societal boundaries can be overcome, that God can guide us to find and be a solution where there's racism and bigotry that's eating our world alive. Can we actually have faith that that could happen through us? Sometimes I have these conversations and I feel like, honestly, like I have no voice in this. I'm a middle-aged white guy. What do I have to say to issues like this, right? People have heard enough of voices like mine. But that doesn't mean that God can't use me somehow, right, to bring healing, to be a part of the solution that helps to heal these hurts and cross these societal boundaries. I don't have to be the voice, right? You don't have to be the voice. Let's just be a voice. I don't have to be a voice in 100 people's lives. Maybe I just have to be a voice in one person's life to cross these societal boundaries. We need breakthrough faith that will let us each step out of our cultural bubbles and into other people's cultural bubbles and help us understand that our personal experiences do not define the reality of what life is like for others. I'm going to say that again. I want you to hear it. My experiences do not define the reality of what life is like for others. We need each other. We need faith not only to go and help people on the other side of societal boundaries. I need help to realize that I need the help of people on the other side of societal boundaries. We need each other's help. The Apostle Paul, after he was transformed by faith in Jesus, he would go on to write that for people of faith, there are no more societal boundaries. We are all brothers and sisters at God's table. And maybe it's just time that some of us got up and moved around at God's table and sat alongside some other brothers and sisters, exposed ourselves to brothers and sisters from other societal groups within and around God's table. Maybe next Sunday, come and sit in a different spot. Maybe come Sunday and sit with some different people and get mixed up, right? And get connected with other people. Breakthrough faith breaks through societal boundaries. And then most of all in this whole thing, the most astounding thing to me is how breakthrough faith breaks through time. Like, Jesus is still working his way toward the cross, and this woman is living in the post-resurrection time. Her faith has her already beyond the cross and beyond the resurrection. That's where she's at, by faith. And at several points in Jesus' ministry, we see the future breaking in as people from other nations come and they experience healing and salvation in him. It's like the kingdom of God can't help but break out into the world. And people like this woman are part of the reason why. She's got a breakthrough faith, a faith that breaks through time. And not just the timing of Jesus' mission where he's still on the way to the cross, but the timing of new creation. She sees past this broken world filled with its evil and its sickness and its pain and its death and its demons. And she sees a new creation where all of these things are kicked out, eradicated, removed from the kingdom of God, the kingdom of the Son of God. And in faith, she calls on the reality of that future to become the reality in her present. And this is what faith is. This is what faith does. Faith breaks through the realities of the present to grab hold of the realities of the future. Faith breaks through the realities of the present to grab hold of the realities of the future that Jesus has won for us. How? By the dear man who taught me how to preach. His name was Haddon Robinson. He passed away last year at the age of 86. I remember him telling a story about his own elderly father and when his father died and talking about what had happened to that man's faith in the last decade or so of his life. Let me read you what he said. He said, "Several years ago, my father passed away at 88 years of age. During his last adult years, my father lived with us in Texas. Before that, he lived in New York City. His family lived in an area of New York called Harlem, in a section of Harlem called Mouse Town, a neighborhood that Reader's Digest said was the toughest section in the United States. The 2 years before my father came to live with us in Dallas, he was beaten up twice by thugs at 80 years old. Once he was knocked down 2 flights of stairs and went to the hospital. The second time he was beaten up, he developed a hernia. He said, my father didn't know what a hernia was, and being a man of simple, perhaps simplistic faith, he asked God to heal him, but nothing happened. When he finally wrote to me to tell me what had occurred, it was obvious that he was deeply upset. I received his letter in the morning, and by that afternoon, I was on a plane to New York City. A day or two later, I brought my father back to Texas where the surgeons successfully operated on him. But my father felt somehow God had disappointed him and let him down. He had prayed for healing, and the healing had not occurred. So I tried to explain to my father that the hand of the physician was the hand of God, but he shrugged all that off, and the last 8 years of my father's life were not good ones. Not only were these years a time of declining health, but he went through them with a diminished faith. And so here I am telling you that Jesus is looking for people with breakthrough faith. That faith breaks through the cold, hard realities of the present and grabs hold of the realities of the future that Jesus has won for us. And some of you, if you're listening and if you're honest, are sitting here thinking, yeah, right, well, I prayed for my daughter and nothing happened. I prayed for my healing and nothing happened. I prayed for my husband to come and be in church with me today, and there, look, next to me, an empty seat. A lot of us are walking around like Haddon's father with diminished faith instead of breakthrough faith. And that's because we haven't yet understood how faith truly operates. We haven't understood how faith brings the reality of the future into the reality of the present. We've ended up thinking in just one way and seeing only one way because we haven't read God's word fully and completely and understood there are multiple ways that faith grabs hold of the future and brings it into the present. That faith sees past the cold, hard, bitter realities of our present and grabs hold of the future Jesus has won for us. And I learned these three from the sermon Haddon preached after telling that story. I learned these three from him, three ways that faith brings the future into the present. The first one is through intervention. I just want to give these to you today. Intervention. This is when God intervenes and does something miraculous. That's what he did in this woman's life. Jesus intervened. She expressed faith and he said, let it be as you have desired. And her daughter's healed. He intervenes miraculously. That's one way. And that's the one everyone gets excited about. Everyone thinks, oh yeah, yeah. Faith, if you have enough faith, that's what's gonna happen. And then when that doesn't happen, we're like, oh, I don't know. I didn't have enough faith. Something's wrong with me. Or I hate God because I had faith and he let me down. Or I don't know what God's doing. You know, we end up in that place because we just focus on the one. That's one way God brings the future into the present. One way our faith can bring the future into the present. There's another way called interaction. And the Bible is full of this way. Sometimes God interacts with us, enabling us to become the difference maker. The way he did, think about it, when he knew famine was coming on the land in Israel and he interacted with Joseph so that Joseph could be the one who would save them from the famine, right? But what did Joseph have to go through in this God using him and interacting with him to bring the reality of the future into the present? He had to be thrown down a well, then brought back up, then sold into slavery, then accused falsely, end up in jail. Then finally, after years and years going through all this stuff, he gets established and then is able to be an instrument of God to bring blessing to God's people. And then that's great, but then they end up being slaves in Egypt eventually. And what does God do? Does he just, boom, miracle them out with a lightning bolt and then they're free? All the Egyptians, boom, drop dead. And now, hey, we own Egypt. No. He answers their cry by interacting with a man named Moses and other faithful people to help bring about rescue, to help bring about the reality of God's promises. Right? God also uses interaction with us. And actually, I would say this is, if you read the Bible, this is the primary way that God brings the realities of the future into the present through men and women who have faith and allow God to work through them to bring the reality of the future into the present. That's what God wants to do through us. That's why God poured out his Holy Spirit on us so that we could be part of interacting with God to bring the realities of the future into the now. The third way, Haddon called it interaction, interaction. Sometimes God interacts with us, does something inside of us. We come to him praying in faith for something and God interacts with us. Paul went through this. Paul had this sickness, this infirmity that was plaguing him and bothering him, and he called it a thorn in his side. And he says in 2 Corinthians 12, he says, three times I pleaded, God, please take it away from me. But God said to him, my grace is sufficient for you,
for my power is made perfect in weakness. And so Paul learned this lesson. This is what he says. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest in me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses. I delight in insults. I delight in hardships and persecutions and difficulties. For when I am weak, that's when I am strong. Can you imagine that becoming the reality of the way you think and approach life? Oh, this is great. Everything went wrong. Oh, this is great. My car broke down. Oh, this is great. I lost my job. Oh, this is great. Once again, I hurt someone's feelings by my stupid mouth. Oh, this is great. This happened, right? Can you imagine having this? Because it's a place where I'm weak. That means God's going to be able to shine through this. God's going to show himself strong through this. Because when I'm weak, that's when I'm strong. Because my strength really comes from God. Can you imagine taking on that mindset and God doing that in you? God interacting in you through hardship to enable you to do that. And that kind of faith is not seen by escaping trouble. God, please get me out. If I have enough faith, God will get me out of this trouble. No, that faith is seen by God interacting in you and me to pass through that trouble in a way that honors him and discovers his strength and lives by his strength. Faith breaks through the realities of the present to grab hold of the realities of the future in those ways. Interaction, intervention, and interaction. A week ago, I finally got the okay to take the footboard off our bed because for like a decade, I've been telling Christina, our bedroom's not big enough, it's too small, the bed doesn't fit in, and it's just too hard for me to get around. She's small, I'm big, but you know, she didn't listen to any of that. But then finally last week, we realized, you know, our dog, what we do is we put a sheet out on the bed during the day so we can jump up and lay there when we're not home. And it's kind of hard for him because he has to jump off the wood floor, and so he actually backs up into like the living room and jumps from the carpet in the living room up onto the bed. It's like getting harder. He's getting older. His leg's a little hurt. So finally, because of the dog, she lets me take. So did you see the sequence in our house? Yeah. So we take the footboard off, put it away, and now the dog can just easily, his bed's at the foot of our bed on the floor, he can just jump from his bed up nice and easy. So she says, come on, buddy, look. And he walks up. She goes, go on, up. And he backs up to the living room again and jumps. For 2 days, he kept doing the same thing as though he had to, as though the football was still there. And I wonder sometimes if that isn't us. We've got these boundaries in our mind. Oh, God's not going to do anything about that. That can't change. That won't change. I won't change. I'm back where I was. I wonder if we're not just accepting some boundaries that in faith we need to start praying through and believing God with a breakthrough faith. And moms, I know that's tough. Today we want to honor you, but also today I want to encourage you and challenge you to take some inspiration from this mother and her breakthrough faith. And I want you to go home and say, God, give me this breakthrough faith too. Her faith that broke through every obstacle to bring the reality of the future of God's kingdom into the present. Be inspired to pray for your children with breakthrough faith. Pray for your children with breakthrough faith. Don't get discouraged when things aren't happening and aren't changing or they're not happening the way you think they should. You may not always know exactly how to pray or what to pray. You may be praying, you know, God, please let this happen, let that happen. Or you may just get, I don't even know, God, what to pray. Just, God knows. God knows. God knows what's best. Just share you the story, real quick story of St. Augustine to encourage you. St. Augustine is one of the most profound men of faith in all of history, a great theologian, 3rd and 4th century, who helped shape Christianity. God used him in powerful ways, a giant of the faith, but he was a messed up teenager. And when he was 16 years old, he took off, abandoned his mom, and ran away. And in those days, you don't run away by jumping on a bus. He jumped on a ship and went to the big city. And I was reading about it in a book by John Piper, Legacy of Sovereign Joy. At 16 years old, the year was 371. So yeah, teenagers haven't changed much. At 16 years old, Augustine sneaks away from his mom, who's there in Carthage, and he jumps on a boat and sails to the big city, to Rome, leaving her alone to her tears and her prayers. How were these prayers answered? Not the way she thought. Augustine would write about it later on. And this is what he wrote about his mom's praying for him and how God answered it. He said, "And what did she beg of you, my God, with all those tears, if not that you would prevent me from sailing? But you did not do as she asked you. Instead, in the depth of your wisdom, you granted the wish that was actually closest to her heart. For she saw that you had granted her far more than she used to ask in her tearful prayers. You converted me to yourself so that I no longer placed any hope in this world, but stood firmly upon the rule of faith. And you turned her sadness into rejoicing, into joy far fuller than her dearest wish, far sweeter and more chaste than any she had hoped to find." Look, you don't know how God's going to answer your prayers for your kids. So I invite you, mothers, to just develop breakthrough faith that prays for them. Let God hear your heart. Don't stop. Don't let anything, any obstacle, any apathy, or any other thing keep you from praying for them. Let your children see your faith. Let them see it. Don't be shamed of it. Don't hold back in pride. Right? Let them see you praying and let them see that sometimes, yeah, maybe your faith shakes, but it doesn't give up. It doesn't quit. Let them see that your faith keeps knocking. It keeps reaching until somehow it breaks through and brings the future that God has for us into the present. Moms, let your kids see that in you. And God will do amazing things more than you and I can even imagine and ask.